content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And we have gotten to the chapter on senescence. It's September and October time in the garden. And our first topic for today is making compost. The volume of yard waste and, to a lesser degree, kitchen scraps will dictate what composting system you use. I create far too much raw material for a typical bin, either the commercially available metal or heavy plastic kind that is about as big as a garbage can, or an easy, inexpensive pen of chicken wire and rot-proof stakes, or a multi-compartment unit fashioned of recycled shipping pallets joined into cubicles. I once had a metal composter that shut tight and kept animals out of my vegetable food waste, alternating them with layers of garden debris and a little soil or finished compost to get things activated and reduce unpleasant odors. Now I just dig a hole in my giant heap, a long open pile called a windrow, and bury food scraps, topping them with a shovel full of compost or rotting debris to deter pests when I dump my kitchen compost bucket. My windrow is about 40 feet long and 6 or 8 feet wide, and in peak fall cleanup gets to more than 5 feet tall, too. But as the material begins to settle and eventually breaks down, it's usually more like 3 to 4 feet high. I also have a pile of shredded leaves only, about 20 feet long and a few feet high, that I age into mulch or soil, improving leaf mold. Next page. Yes, you can just make a pile in a corner of the yard, no enclosure required. Don't site the heap in the shadows, though. A position in at least part day sun is better, and also one near a water source, or the pile can be kept slightly moist but not sodden. There is no precise recipe, just a traditional formula of green plus brown equals black gold. Layer the two. Green ingredients, nitrogen-rich materials such as grass clippings and leafy green plants, and brown ones, carbon-rich dry brown leaves or twiggy bits. Too much of either will impede decomposition. Never add fats and oils, dairy products, eggshells or fine, meat, fish or bones, or pet manures. Also, avoid manures from farm animals who have been fed crops treated with persistent herbicides, which can render your pile killer compost that thwarts plant growth. I liken successful composting to the combustion that goes on when my car is running smoothly. To ignite the car needs fuel, air, and a spark. The heap spark is the nitrogen-rich green stuff. The fuel is the brown stuff. The air is supplied by occasional turning of the pile. too much green stuff in one spot, particularly wet things like grass clippings, will produce a smelly heap. Too much brown, like thick piles of orange rinds if you are into juicing, will just sit there. Chopping things up speeds decomposition, so does aerating the pile by turning or adding more green. For good measure, I inoculate the pile of fresh materials here and there with a shovel full of microbe-filled aged compost or garden soil, and skip the store-bought inoculants. Composting hot between 120 and 160 degrees Fahrenheit will help kill weed seeds and most funky stuff. An 18-inch long compost thermometer will help eliminate guesswork. If weeds are sprouting from finished compost, heat up the pile or pre-kill weeds and weed seeds by bagging them in plastic with some green material, like lawn clippings, and leaving the bags in the sun for a few months before returning the solarized material to the heap. The bagging idea is great, a sort of waste not, want not tactic for recycling weeds versus tossing them into the trash, and you can even reuse the same bags. Our next topic is a longer clematis season. With a strategy combining proper plant selection, timely cutbacks, feeding, and vigilant watering, we can stretch the blooming season of clematis, Dan Long, or brushwood nursery, a vine mad friend, has got me thinking. First, select a range of clematis, not all spring bloomers. If you have mostly large flowered hybrids, which bloom in late spring, you won't have explored earlier and later moments. A rough sequence of some possibilities. Extra early varieties are being developed by breeders, and the Alpina, Montana, and Macropetala species and their hybrids are all early. Even among the large flower hybrids, which come after these, there are early and later selections to stretch your time with them. The Viticella hybrids don't have flowers as big, but are prolific and easy. Clematis integrifolia, which can bloom for a long time, behaves more like a herbaceous perennial at maybe 3 feet, and there are hybrids with integrifolia that add those long-blooming genetics to slightly more scrambling or semi-climbing plants. Probably the best-known one of those would be Durandi. My late spring, summer, and autumn, you can enjoy the Orientalis group, including Clematis tangutica and the white-flowered native C. virginiana, less showy and fragrant than the long popular sweet autumn clematis C. paniculata, which is invasive in many places. I have vastly oversimplified, but you get the idea. Shop for a sequence of blooms and for varieties with good seed heads too. Then, feed the plants organic rose fertilizer. Water regularly. Good steady fertilizing using an all-natural organic food rated for roses can bring on more blooms. How often and how much depends on soil conditions and the specific product. Follow label application rates. Top dress each plant in spring or fall with compost. A regular supply of water can make a critical difference between a plant surviving and thriving. These deep-rooted perennials can be set back by dry spells. Drip irrigation is ideal, but if not, plan to water thoroughly and frequently. Some plants respond to a mid-season cutback too. After their massive blooms, the large flowered hybrids can look ratty. Cut back a third or half, feed and water well, promoting a flush of growth and possible rebloom. Some, like Jackmini, may rebloom promptly. Others later or not so much. But the cutback and TLC won't hurt. I cut my non-vining clematis, like Clematis recta, to the ground after bloom, too, and they respond with tidier, fresh foliage and perhaps even more flowers. And our next topic is when inner conifer needles turn brown. Don't panic. Nothing's wrong. And they're not all dying in unison. Though we commonly call them evergreens, conifers such as pine, arborvita, spruce, and hinoki cypress lighten their load of old needles in late summer and fall, with a show of yellowing or browning that can scare a gardener. This phenomenon should not be confused with browning at the tips or overall yellowing or browning that can happen at other times, such as from winter desiccation, from roadside salts, from pests and diseases, including diplodia, tip blight in some pines, or phimosis in spruce and non-resistant junipers, or from drought. Do a web search to see what road salt damage and winter burn look like on conifers by comparison. The browning I noticed in late July on my eastern red cedar, Juniperus virginiana, is suddenly showing up as gold or rusty brown or a progression on other species. The eastern white pine, with its long needles, is always the most dramatic, turning what looks like mostly gold. It's hard to believe the plant will be okay, but needle drop is normal, though the rate varies by species and can also accelerate from environmental stresses like dry conditions or pest infestation in a given season. Before calling the arborist, examine a branch to identify where along it the fading foliage is. Losses should generally be from the inside out, not at the tips. Inner leaves are the oldest, and as they age and get shaded by new growth farther out, they photosynthesize less effectively and are shed. The plant lightens its load, and good thing, since snow and ice on extra needles could be too much to bear. All conifers drop their needles every couple of years to every 5 years or longer. The deciduous conifers, such as Dawn Redwood, Bald Cypress, and Larch, do it thoroughly every year, But that's another story. And our next topic is putting up a year of herbs. I hate paying a couple of dollars for a bunch of organic parsley in winter, or chives, or cilantro, or sage. And twice that for basil, if you can get it. As summer heats up, I start freezing herbs and do big batches before they're gone. Not a perfect substitute for fresh, but very good and economical. I do it one of three ways. As pesto, using oil as the base, sometimes with extra ingredients. As ice cubes, whole or chopped, pressed into trays and covered in a tiny bit of water, or blended with just enough water to make a cube. Or stuffed tightly into freezer bags or small freezer jars. The how-tos. Pesto flavored or plain. Get out a food processor or blender and get creative. Puree virtually any green herbs, from chives to parsley, basil, oregano, cilantro, arugula, sage, and even garlic scraps in season. Garlic scapes in season. In an olive oil base. Some cooks add garlic and or nuts and grated cheese. Some think the mixture doesn't store as well with extras. Freeze as cubes, knocked out of ice cube trays into freezer bags with air expressed. Here's another way, is freeze herbs as ice cubes. This method is preferable when an oil base doesn't suit, such as for lemon balm or other mints, or with other green herbs that might be used later in a recipe that does not call for olive oil. Wash herbs, pat dry, and remove from stems. Chop if needed, or simply press densely into ice cube trays and drizzle a little water over to fill, barely enough so a cube will form when frozen. Or process the herbs with a little water as the base and then make cubes, and when frozen, pop them into freezer bags. Freezing rosemary, thyme, or bay. Some herbs are easiest to freeze right on the stems, including rosemary, thyme, and bay. If you are so lucky as to have a bay tree, simply cut the twigs, spread out on a cookie sheet, and put into the freezer. Once frozen, pack twigs into freezer bags by variety. Express the air and simply pick off leaves from a twig any time, returning unused twigs to the bag. Or after they are thoroughly frozen, a week or more, you can unbag the twigs briefly, detach the foliage by hand or with a rolling pin, then pack the frozen leaves quickly back into freezer jars or bags. Freeze herbs in logs of leaves. I use a lot of parsley, making logs of leaflets pressure rolled tightly inside freezer bags. The long log technique, so easy and probably the only cooking good thing I contributed in my years at Martha Stewart Living, though my record with gardening ideas was better, goes like this. Wash and dry parsley in a salad spinner. Remove leaflets from stems and press loads into the bottom of a quart freezer bag until there is about the diameter of a half dollar. densely packed when you roll up the bag. Seal expressing air and surround the log with rubber bands for good measure. When you need some, you just slice a disc from one end of the log and return the rest to the bag and freezer. Chopped chives also freeze well this way, or in small freezer jars. And friends report doing this with various green herbs that I have not tried firsthand. Basil, because it blackens, is one I would not, but rather put up in oil or water as a cube. One year, I had a big fall crop of dill, and I just removed the thickest lower stem, then folded up the plants to fill a freezer bag like a thick mat, then gradually chopped off bits as needed from the frozen mass. Ways to use frozen herbs. As an ingredient in a soup or stew or sauce. With pesto cubes as a garnish for soups and stews. Again, with pesto spread on crackers or bread, served as appetizers or to otherwise accompany a meal. Pestos on pasta or rice as a main dish or side. To enliven a sandwich or a egg dish, I love them in frittatas and omelets, for example. Plain frozen herb leaves are not great as a garnish on, say, a salad because they can be limp, but mix them into the dressing instead. And our next topic is, I just called them asters. I still recall the suspicious glare of the person beside me in the checkout line at the garden center a couple of dozen springs ago when I was buying asters and she was buying azaleas. Her purchases were blooming. Mine looked dead. She was smug then, but came fall, it's pretty clear who got the better deal. Because they flower so late and don't look like much earlier on, asters were for too long one of the lessons learned late in a gardener's career after years of having things peter out by fall and scurrying to find solutions. With the increasing emphasis on native plants and especially on pollinator plantings, asters are especially loved by bees. Syrphid flies and butterflies. The message of their value is being heard sooner. I learned about them in two places. The former Heronswood Nursery catalog from Daniel Hinckley near Seattle, which listed more than 50 at one count and outdoors all around me each fall. Many wild asters representing numerous native eastern species pop up around the garden and the surrounding fields and roadsides and even in the woods. The first aster to intentionally find a home with me, though, thanks to a mail order placed at Heronswood, was the hybrid Little Carlo with dime-sized violet-blue flowers produced over many weeks. Another winner in the genus was that was aster, but is now divided into various others, is what I first knew as A. lateriflorus, var horizontalis, with sprays of tiny flowers on wide-spreading branches that the horizontalis part gave away. Now the calico aster is called Symphyotrichum lateriflorum. And like many gardeners, I like the cultivar Lady in Black, for its dark leaves and profusion of white daisies with rose-colored centers. It is one of the plants known as a weaver, as is the species S. cordifolium, or heart-leaved aster, another volunteer at my place. Most asters bloom as autumn comes on, from late August to right up against hard frost, as late as November. Plan accordingly. Asters are generally sun lovers, though Eurybia divaricata, formerly Aster divaricatus, the charming white wood aster, and inclined to be thuggish, big-leaved aster, or Eurybia macrophylla, formerly A. macrophyllus, a name, too, can handle shade and pop up at the woodland edge here and under big trees. There are an estimated 250 to 300 species of asters worldwide. Even asters adapted to beach areas or the wet. Each year, I promise myself to track down an expert and learn the rest of my local natives and the best garden selections of each. The trick is to learn to tolerate their early appearance, like the ones in my shopping cart that long ago spring day, which ranges from nondescript to downright weedy. Conventional wisdom says to lift asters and divide them regularly for most vigorous performance. With the taller ones, it's also advisable to pinch or prune them once or twice before letting them fill out and bloom to ensure bushier, more compact plants. The timing for this might be mid-June or even July 4th, but probably no later. Whack them back to about 6 inches, something deer did for me before I had a fence, and rabbits or woodchucks do if I am not vigilant nowadays about keeping them away. Don't pinch the naturally compact ones like the arresting scaled-down New England aster cultivar, because purple dome or its raspberry-colored sport vibrant dome or the nearly prostrate white one called Cynthia Snowy Flurry. We've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Dean Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. And be sure to join us next time for another part of the book.